Greet you in Jesus' name. It's good to be together again. I remember the first time that I heard about God's grace and His love for me. The reason I remember is because, you know, growing up, we didn't go to church. My family, my mother, my father, you know, we didn't have a Bible in the home. We didn't have any of that. And I remember about the age of 10, 9, there was Bible school in the community. And I remember sort of going just to see what it was like, not really having any interest as such, not really having expectations as such. I didn't know what it was like, really. I may have been in a church a time or two up to that point. If I was, I wouldn't remember it. Certainly very few times, but I remember going to that church. It was a small church there in the community where I lived. It was a Baptist church, and I remember just enjoying myself there. We had activities. We had, you know, things like you do in Bible school. We had lessons that were new to me. They were new to me. I didn't know what they were about. I didn't know anything about Abraham. I didn't know anything about, you know, any of that. But I do remember, I probably forgot all of that, you know, over the years. I may have went to Bible school the next summer, I'm not sure, but it soon fell by the wayside. I wasn't going to Bible school anymore, and I forgot just about everything that they would have taught me, but there's one thing that I never forgot, and it followed me all the way up through, and that was John 3:16. They taught me to memorize John 3:16. For God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in Him should not perish but have everlasting life. And you know, I've never forgotten that verse. That verse is very powerful. And it expresses God's heart to each one of us, no matter where we are, no matter what we've experienced, no matter what we've done. God is concerned about you. He loves you, and He wants to save your soul. That is the only reason that He sent Jesus into the world. And if there's nothing else you remember throughout this week, we pray that it's that God loves you. He has a plan for you, and it's true that, you know, Sim addressed the thing of individuals abusing grace and living in sin. We're not talking about that. But God loves you, and He wants to change your heart. He wants to give you a new heart. So I'm eternally thankful to Him for the grace that He showed me. It's a long story, but it was very tender, reminding me and prompting me and bringing me to the realization that He loves me. And He had no good reason to. You know, I lived a life such that He didn't have any good reason to love me. You know, if you're part of a family and you interact with the family, they love you because you're part of the family and your family. And well, I didn't do anything that would make Him love me or anyone else love me. And I knew that, and it brought conviction. Well, that's not the message this evening. The message this evening is found in the book of 1 Kings chapter 13, actually beginning in chapter 12. It's a message primarily directed at the church, and it, of course, addresses individuals because the church is made up of individuals. But it begins in a time of Israel when there was a lot of turmoil. Beginning in verse 25 of chapter 12, it says, "Then Jeroboam built Shechem in Mount Ephraim, and dwelt therein, and went out from thence, and built Penuel. And Jeroboam said in his heart, Now shall the kingdom return to the house of David. If this people go up to do sacrifice in the house of the Lord at Jerusalem, then shall the heart of this people turn again unto the Lord, their Lord, even unto Rehoboam, king of Judah, and they shall kill me and go again to Rehoboam, king of Judah. Whereupon the king took counsel and made two calves of gold and said unto them, It is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Behold thy gods, O Israel, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. And he set the one in Bethel, and the other he put in Dan. And this thing became a sin, for the people went to worship before the one, even unto Dan. And he made an house of high places, and made priests of the lowest of the people, which were not of the sons of Levi. And Jeroboam ordained a feast in the eighth month, on the 15th day of the month, like unto the feast that is in Judah. And he offered upon the altar, so did he in Bethel, sacrificing unto the calves that he had made. And he placed in Bethel the priest of the high places, which he had made. He offered upon the altar which he had made in Bethel, the 15th day of the eighth month, even in the month which he had devised of his own heart, and ordained a feast unto the children of Israel. And he offered upon the altar and burnt incense. Like I mentioned, this was a time of transition for Israel. Jeroboam was an individual that was anointed by a prophet named Ahijah. That is found in 1 Kings chapter 11, verses 29 through 31, if you want to look at that. But Jeroboam was an individual that lived during the time of Solomon. Because of the abominations of Solomon, God said in 1 Kings 11 and verse 33, because that they have forsaken me and have worshipped Ashtaroth and the goddess of the Zidonians, Chemosh, the god of the Moabites, and Milcom, etc. It goes down through and lists a long list of foreign gods that the children of Israel had gone to worship with Solomon, building temples in dedication to them in Jerusalem, descending into apostasy. Because of all of that, God anointed Jeroboam that he would reign over 10 tribes of Israel. There were 12. The only two tribes that were not were Judah and Benjamin. We see that after the death of Solomon, the people in chapter 12 and verse 1, let me find my place. In 12 and verse 3, this is Jeroboam and the people, and they sent and called him, and Jeroboam, and all the congregation of Israel came, and spake unto Rehoboam, that's the son of Solomon, saying, thy father made our yoke grievous, now therefore make thou the grievous service of thy father and his heavy yoke which he put upon us lighter, and we will serve thee. Rehoboam went from here and conferred with the old men, the old counselors of the kingdom of Solomon, and they agreed that the service should be lightened. And I think if we would consider the hard bondage that the children of Israel lived under with Solomon, we would agree that they should be lightened. You know, when you think of the levies and the taxes and the, you know, the project that Solomon had going, and he burdened the people. Instead of that, Rehoboam decided that he would not honor that. It says in verse 15 of chapter 12, wherefore the king hearkened not unto the people, for the cause was from the Lord, that he might perform his saying, which the Lord spake by Ahijah, the Shilonite, unto Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. Because of that, the children of Israel rebelled, and Jeroboam split the kingdom. That's where we find ourselves in the verses tonight. Jeroboam built Shechem and Mount Ephraim and dwelt therein and went out from thence and built Penuel. And it says that he also built two calves to worship, the one in Dan and the other in Bethel. The reason that he did that is because he did not want the children of Israel returning back to Jerusalem to worship the one true God in the temple, because he feared that as the people did that, they would return to God and kill him. So he made these gods to worship in Dan and also in Bethel. Really, none of that has to do with the story that, or the message that I want to consider this evening. What I want to consider is chapter 13 in verse 1. That was background leading to the verses that I want to consider. Reading verse 1 of chapter 13, "And behold, there came a man of God out of Judah by the word of the Lord unto Bethel. And Jeroboam stood by the altar to burn incense, and he cried against the altar and the word of the Lord, and said, O altar, altar, thus saith the Lord, behold, a child shall be born unto the house of David, Josiah by name. And upon thee shall he offer the priests of the high places that burn incense upon thee, and men's bones shall be burnt upon thee. And he gave a sign the same day, saying, This is the sign which the Lord has spoken. Behold, the altar shall be rent, and the ashes that are upon it shall be poured out. And it came to pass, when King Jeroboam heard the saying of the man of God, which he cried against the altar in Bethel, that he put forth his hand from the altar, saying, Lay hold on him, and his hand which he had put forth against him dried up, so that he could not pull it in again unto him. The altar also was rent, and the ashes poured out from the altar, according to the sign which the man of God had given by the word of the Lord. And the king answered and said unto the man of God, Entreat now the face of the Lord thy God, and pray for me, that my hand may be restored me again. And the man of God besought the Lord, and the king's hand was restored him again, and became as it was before. And the king said unto the man of God, Come home with me, and refresh thyself, and I will give thee a reward. And the man of God said unto the king, If thou wilt give me half thine house, I will not go in with thee, neither will I eat bread nor drink water in this place. For so was it charged me by the word of the Lord, saying, Eat no bread, nor drink water, nor turn again by the same way that thou camest. So he went another way, and returned not by the way that he came to Bethel. Now there dwelt in an old prophet in Bethel. Remember that. The old prophet in Bethel. Such a sad story. It goes on, and his sons came and told him all the works that the man of God had done that day in Bethel, and the words which he had spoken unto the king. Them they told also to their father. And their father said unto them, What way went he? For his sons had seen what way the man of God went, which came from Judah. And he said unto his sons, Saddle me the ass. So they saddled him the ass, and he rode thereon, and went after the man of God, and found him sitting under an oak. And he said unto him, Art thou the man of God that camest from Judah? And he said, I am. Then he said unto him, Come home with me, and eat bread. And he said, I may not return with thee, nor go in with thee, neither will I eat bread, nor drink water with thee in this place. For it was said to me by the word of the Lord, Thou shalt eat no bread, nor drink water there, nor turn again to go by the way that thou camest. He said unto him, I am a prophet also, as thou art. And an angel spake unto me by the word of the Lord, saying, Bring him back with thee into thine house, that he may eat bread and drink water. But he lied unto him. A prophet, an old prophet, lied to this young man. So he went back with him, did eat bread in his house, and drank water. And it came to pass, as they sat at the table, that the word of the Lord came unto the prophet that brought him back. And he cried unto the man of God that came from Judah, saying, Thus saith the Lord, Forasmuch as thou hast disobeyed the mouth of the Lord, and hast not kept the commandment which the Lord thy God commanded thee, but camest back and hast eaten bread, and drunk water in the place of the which the Lord did say to thee, Eat no bread, and drink no water, thy carcass shall not come unto the sepulchre of thy fathers. And it came to pass, after he had eaten bread, and after he had drunk, that he saddled for him the ass, to wit, for the prophet whom he had brought back. And when he was gone, a lion met him by the way and slew him. And his carcass was cast in the way, and the ass stood by it, The lion also stood by the carcass. And behold, men passed by and saw the carcass cast in the way and the lion standing by the carcass. And they came and told it in the city where the old prophet dwelt. And when the prophet that brought him back from the way heard thereof, he said, "It is the man of God whom was disobedient unto the word of the Lord." Therefore, the Lord hath delivered him unto the lion which hath torn him, and slain him according to the word of the Lord which he spake unto him. And he spake to his son, saying, "Saddle me the ass." And they saddled him. And he went and found his carcass cast in the way, and the ass and the lion standing by the carcass. The lion had not eaten the carcass nor torn the ass. And the prophet took up the carcass and the man of God and laid it upon the ass and brought it back. And the old prophet came to the city to mourn and to bury him. And he laid his carcass in his own grave, and they mourned over him, saying, "Alas, my brother." And it came to pass after he had buried him that he spake to his son, saying, "When I am dead, then bury me in the sepulchre where the man of God is buried. Lay my bones beside his bones, for the saying which he cried by the word of the Lord against the altar in Bethel, and against all the houses of the high places which are in the cities of Samaria, shall surely come to pass." And indeed it did come to pass. Josiah by name, chosen of God, 350 years before, did exactly as the prophecy indicated. He broke the sepulchres and poured the bones out upon the altars and destroyed them 15 generations later. And it says, if you would go into 2 Kings, I think it's chapter 23, you could read there about how that King Josiah, he saw one of the sepulchres with writing on it. And he asked what it was, and they said that it was the sepulchre of the prophet that is mentioned here, the good prophet that warned Jeroboam against the idolatry that he was doing, committing, and leading his people into sin. And because of that, the altar was not desecrated. The bones were not broken. The sepulchre was not torn down. And it also says there in 2 Kings that the bones of this old prophet lay in that sepulchre safely as well. Neither was his bones broken and scattered and defiled, because they were placed in the sepulchre of the good prophet. There are a number of passages in the scriptures where I pause. This is one such example. The reason that I pause is because it's somewhat disturbing to me. I'm not sure how you feel about the events that happened here. You have a young man, and he's not even named, that I found, that I can remember. I don't think he's named anywhere. All that we know is that he's from Judah. He was sent by God to carry the message to Jeroboam that he should desist from what he's doing, that it was sin, that he would be accountable for it, and there would be a future price to pay as well. And that's true for us as well, is it not? Sin will not go unpunished. You know, we might get through a day or a week or a month or a year or even years. You know, we hear today about people and how that they've went for 15, 20, 25, 30 years, and you know what? DNA brings the crime back home. Well, God's better than any DNA. You know, he knows exactly what happened, when it happened, where it happened, and how it happened. And there's not a one of us going to be able to escape the judgment that he will bring in our lives if we do not forsake and confess sin. That is the facts. And that will happen. Do we realize that it took 15 generations for Josiah to complete the prophecy? Well, it doesn't matter if it's 15 generations or 15,000. God will not forget, and he will judge sin. So we had best deal with that today. But as I was mentioning, I struggled for a long time, and probably still have a struggle about this passage. I think it makes sense to me now, but there was a long time that I avoided the passage for the most part. I read it, but enjoy isn't the right word. It's just, it wasn't a favorite passage of mine. The reason being, I felt that God was unfair. You know, you think of this young man and how that he came all that distance. Really, it wasn't that far. It was only possibly 8-10 miles. It wasn't that far, but you know, he was walking in obedience to God. He took the chance, and he had courage, and he went and rebuked the king, a king that was very ruthless. You know, he would have had no problem taking the life of this young man. And the young man knew that. I'm sure that he did. But the young man goes, and he tries to follow everything that God said. You have the king who wants to give him a reward. It says so in verse 7. And the king said unto the man of God, come home with me and refresh thyself, and I will give thee a reward. And the young man refused, because God had told him in verse 8, if thou wilt give me half of thine house, I will not go in with thee, neither will I eat bread nor drink water in this place. For so was it charged me by the word of the Lord, saying, eat no bread, nor drink water, nor turn again by the same way that thou camest. And he was obedient to that with the king. He did not eat, he did not drink, he did not take any refreshment, and he went out another way. We know that because the sons of the old prophet, if had they not known which direction he went in, they wouldn't have known where to find him. Because he did not come, he did not go the way that he came. But then you have the example of the old prophet and how that he, it says that he lied to him in verse 18. You know, he told the prophet in verse 18 that an angel had came to him, unto him by the word of the Lord, saying, bring him back with me into thine house that he may eat bread and drink water. But he lied unto him. It was because of that deception that the young prophet lost his life to a lion. We know that it was miraculous because the lion did not eat him. It just simply sat there by the road. It didn't eat the donkey. The donkey was safe. The old prophet was able to come and to retrieve the body of the young prophet. You know, it was all miraculous. It was God's intervention and judgment on the young prophet. I do realize that I've made a mistake in avoiding these passages. You know, we can think of Uzzah too. Do you remember Uzzah? And how that they were transporting the ark. And he was just there trying to, I think, do his part. And the ark, you know, the oxen stumbled, says, and the ark rumbled, and it was apparently about to fall off the cart. And Uzzah stretched forth his hand to stable the ark so that it wouldn't fall, and he died instantly. And it says that David was, by his response, he was frightened by that. He didn't understand. And you know, I think for a long time I didn't understand either why this had to happen in the way that it did. And you know, I think I've gotten to the place, I have gotten to the place that I see my mistake. It's just like it was recorded of Joseph and all the things that he experienced, that even this happened unto him for our example and for our admonition. We need to consider it and what it means. I believe, first of all, God's response was a matter of integrity. Now think about what I'm saying. The prophet went, he rebuked the king, he told him what would happen in 350 years. And it happened to the letter, to the very smallest part, it was fulfilled. And we got to understand this evening that God will keep His promises. He will. Now, doesn't the same integrity apply to the command that He gave the young prophet? You know, if the young man disobeyed, you know, for whatever reason, and we don't understand it because it doesn't seem fair to us, but as he violated the command of God, really God had no choice but to bring judgment on the young man. Because God is just. He is true. He changes not. You know, imagine what it would be if he had let that thing just sort of slide. You know, I would have let it slide. Sim, would you have let it slide? I don't know. Sim probably wouldn't. Sim's, you know, he's careful. But I would have probably let it slide if it had been up to me. But think about what a terrible thing it would be if God started letting things slide. Because, you know, after a while, you know, what is that man going to let slide? You know, it might be something we think's important. We need to know where we stand. We need to know what he expects of us. So it's a matter of integrity. That was the first mistake that I made. The second mistake that I think I made, that I know I made, was in the way that I viewed the sin of the young man. Because really, if I'd let that thing slide the way that I think I would naturally want to do, it's because I considered it a small, you know, it was a slip. It was not something that was grievous. It was not something, you know, it was small. Smaller. But I think that we need to understand that with sin, with all sin, there isn't small sin. Sin is sin. And sin separates from God. Small, big, little, it doesn't matter. What's the Bible say? If we offend in one point, we've offended in all points. You know, sin is sin. In whatever capacity, in whatever form, and sin always separates from communication and communion with God. So I think I made a mistake in those two areas. Now, I want to, for the remainder of the service, consider two reasons why I think that the old prophet was successful in deceiving the young prophet. And I want to make application for us today in our churches that we fellowship in. Why was the prophet successful, the old prophet? When others failed to persuade him to depart from the truth. First of all, I think that he was deceived because the request seemed reasonable. You know, if you think of the response of the young prophet, he had followed a good bit of what was commanded of him. Like I mentioned before, Bethel and Judah, they weren't far apart. You know, there was one calf that was way up in Dan. That was the northern part of the kingdom. And there was another one that was in Bethel, and he went to the calf that was in Bethel. So you're looking at 8-10 miles, possibly a little more, till you would be completely out of the area of Bethel, and you would actually be completely back in Judah. And it was also true that he did not eat bread at that place. He had not accepted any of the gifts that were offered to him, and he did return to journey home another way. So I think it could be reasonable to think that he followed the spirit of the law that was given to him. You know, that's the way reason works, isn't it? You know, you start to make allowance, because he kept most of it. He honored the spirit of what was commanded, but maybe not the letter. You know, the letter, he didn't follow exactly what it said. But you see, reason is that way. Reason is dangerous. The problem with reason is that it is not reliable. Reason fails because our hearts are not consistently dependable. We need a standard which will judge the thoughts and intents of our hearts, and that's where Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 12 comes in. It is possible with the hearts that we possess to, you think about something that you really want to do, you know, and you know you shouldn't do it, or someone tells you you shouldn't do it, but you really want to do it. And those wheels start to turn in your head. And you start to put thought to that and you start to reason it out. You know, I don't know how it is for you, but at least for me, it's possible to explain away quite a number of things. It's just that way. Reason. You know, against reason, I think that we need to put up some defenses. I think that we need to recognize the tendency for ourselves to make allowance for ourselves and to be willingly ignorant. You know, you sometimes you hear the phrase, ignorance is bliss. Well, it's not. It doesn't apply. We need to put things in place that help us to work against that tendency in our lives. And what I would suggest this evening is that against the confusion of reason, our only defense is found in a four-letter word, and that is O-B-E-Y. What does that say? Spell. It spells obey. You see, when God says it, we believe it, and that should settle it. Because when God says it and He's commanded us to do it, that's all we need. In order to defend against all of the deception that might approach our lives, we just simply obey. You know, when God commands us to do something, that's what we do. We obey. And that is what Jesus did. The example that we have in Matthew chapter 4 of the temptation of Christ, it says there, "Then was Jesus led up of the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted of the devil. And when he had fasted 40 days and 40 nights, he was afterward and hungered. And when the tempter came to him, he said, If thou be the Son of God, command that these stones be made bread. But he answered and said, It is written, Man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceedeth out of the mouth of God. Then the devil taketh him up into the holy city, and setteth him on a pinnacle of the temple, and saith unto him, If thou be the Son of God, cast thyself down, for it is written, He shall give his angels charge concerning thee, and in their hands they shall bear thee up, lest at any time thou dash thy foot against a stone. Jesus said unto him, It is written again, Thou shalt not tempt the Lord thy God. Again the devil taketh him up into an exceeding high mountain, and showeth him all the kingdoms of the world, and the glory of them, and saith unto him, All these things will I give thee, if thou wilt fall down and worship me. Then saith Jesus unto him, Get thee hence, Satan, for it is written, Thou shalt worship the Lord thy God, and him only shalt thou serve. In each one of these instances of temptation, and I think they're broad examples of temptation, you know, we think of bread, pride, and power. You know, that's something that we all face in different ways and in a variety of examples. But in each one of those, when the devil came to him, his response was, It is written, and he referred him back to the scriptures. Today, to be a Christian is to accept the authority of the scriptures. And the only way that we will experience victory in our lives is if we endeavor, if we walk in obedience to the revealed word of God. We obey. We just simply obey. It says in 1 Corinthians 11 and verse 6, Let her be covered. So we agree with God and we veil our sisters. In 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 9, it says, In like manner also that women adorn themselves in modest apparel, with shamefacedness and sobriety, not with broided hair, or gold, or pearls, or costly array. You know, that doesn't just apply to the sisters. We recognize that applies to the men as well. So we endeavor to live simply. You know, whether that be our watch bands, our shoes, you know, the type of vehicles we drive, you know, whatever it is, We try to honor the command that is given there. We honor simplicity. We honor modesty. We honor shamefacedness. 1 Corinthians 16 and verse 20. There it says, all the brethren greet you. Greet you one another with an holy kiss. So we agree with God and we greet one another with an holy kiss of charity. In Matthew chapter 5 and verse 40, and if any man will sue thee at the law and take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also. And whosoever shall compel thee to go a mile, go with him twain. Give to him that asketh thee, and from him that would borrow of thee, turn thou not away. So we agree with God in non-resistance. You know, we don't resist, we don't sue, we don't fight. You know, all of these things, because we obey. And think about it this evening, of all of the things that we are saved from, just simply because we choose to obey. If it says it, that's good enough for me. You know, you have individuals that make reference to the scriptures there where it says that some of these things are done, you know, that's a custom. But, it may have been. It may have been in that time, but you know what? God saw fit that that was a custom that would bless us too. So he expects us to honor that in our day too. So we just simply obey. You know, there's sometimes that we don't understand why. You know, the young people, there's things that maybe you don't, and even the older ones, there's things I don't understand completely. But you know what? You just simply obey. Even when you don't understand, even when it doesn't seem to make sense, you simply obey. One of those things that happens for me that I had to simply obey was that coming from the area there, or from the setting that I did, I didn't go to church until I was. Well, I went to Bible school those couple of times, but I was 19 or 20 till I ever really went to church. And about 21 till I started going to a Mennonite church. And I enjoyed it. I did. And I stayed and I grew. And it was good. But there was things that were different. Like the Holy Kiss. You know, it's one thing that I struggled with. I wasn't used to it, didn't completely understand it, but you know what? There's a blessing that comes when you simply obey. After a while, you begin to understand, and after a while, you begin to accept, and after a while, you agree with God that happy are you if you do these things. You know, we begin to agree with God. We simply obey. Jeremiah 29, verse 11 says, for I know the thoughts that I think toward you, saith the Lord, thoughts of peace and not of evil, to give you an expected end. And that word expected there means hope, to give you a hopeful end. God knows what we need. Do we recognize that this evening? God knows what we need. And he has provided for that in every way. So we simply obey. Now, in thinking of the second reason why I think that the young man fell to the deception of the old prophet was because that the request came from a brother. And we see that response even from the old prophet and his sons, and how that they came upon his dead body and they said, alas, my brother. You know, and that really goes hard, doesn't it? You know, you see the grief they seem to be showing, and you wonder, well, why? Why did they do to him what they did? But we can't answer for them. But it came from a brother. You know, not only was the individual a brother, but he was also an elder. He identifies himself as a prophet. And the young man understood, however he did, that the individual was a prophet. And he was much older, so there was that aspect as well. But the danger for the young man came from within the camp. It wasn't a danger that was from outside. You know, we're saying that it came from within the church. That was the danger that he faced, because in the sense that it was then, that's exactly like it would be today. The danger came from within. And the warning is clear. Just because someone close to us is promoting a thing, we still need to be very careful. And we need to consider what they're saying and why they're saying it. And we need to consider how it applies to the scriptures. We need to be like the Bereans and receive the word with all readiness of mind. But we also need to search the scriptures daily whether those things are so. You know, we could think of Adam and Eve. You know, when the temptation came, primarily the temptation came to Eve, did it not? The serpent came, and it was very beautiful. I don't like any serpent, but apparently it was a little different then, or maybe she didn't mind serpents, I don't know. I guess serpents can be beautiful, but it had legs. So it was different. It was a different kind of animal than what we got today. The serpent came and deceived Eve, and she fell. She ate the fruit of knowledge of good and evil. And did you ever notice how that she took the fruit to Adam, and the serpent wasn't really involved at that point? You know, she took the fruit to Adam. And I believe there's a reason for that. The Bible says that Adam was not into the deception. He wasn't deceived by what had happened. But because of who the threat came from, he was willing to yield and to disobey and to commit sin. And I think we see that sometimes today with individuals because of their affection, because of its family, or because of, you know, sometimes we see parents and how that they're willing to make allowance for their children in ways that are surprising because, you know, they didn't grow up that way. They didn't, when they were young, they didn't promote that, but they seem to be changing with their children. I think that's some of the same process at work. The danger is coming from within the camp, and we're not careful. We don't have our guards up. You know, today we hear the call for accommodation couched in phrases like others are doing it. And I think that I think we would all agree that there probably are others doing it. But that doesn't mean we should do it, does it? Doesn't mean we should do it. And I think we need to be very careful. You know, our conference has a real blessing for us, I think. You know, the structure is such that we can be really blessed. But when we start looking around and we start trying to excuse things that we're doing because someone else is doing it, I think that's dangerous. You know, I think that's not going to be a blessing for us in our lives. It doesn't matter. You know, if there's an issue over here and someone else is doing something, and that doesn't mean we can do it. In fact, if it's questionable, they shouldn't be doing it either. And we really shouldn't be looking to use that as a reason to justify what we're doing. You know, we need to avoid becoming a lawyer. You know what lawyers do? They have a lot of fine print. You know, they start looking for the fine print. They write to fine print too, don't they? And you do need to read that. But a lawyer mentality is such that you begin to dig and dig, and you look for chinks. You look for little areas of weakness where you can begin to dig at and get a hold on, a purchase. And you work at that thing. And there's another danger, sort of a lawyer problem that we can have too sometimes. It's called jurisprudence. Jurisprudence is the tendency for once a decision has been made by a judge, that will establish credibility for that decision. And if there's another judge that does that, and say there's three or four or five or six that make the same type of ruling on a decision, then that's jurisprudence. And after a while, it'll make a bad decision that maybe a handful of judges made very difficult to challenge. Because there's these backlogs of instances of where other people have done it. You know, we need to avoid that. We need to We need to not compare ourselves among ourselves, as the scripture says, that is not wise. Today I'm convinced that individuals may and do find many churches and Mennonites who lend numerical weight to questionable decisions. I think that we should expect such and not allow the fact that others do it to convince us that we should. We need to ask not what is wrong with it, but what is right with it. I think that's a question that we need to ask. And we need to not allow numbers to lessen the danger represented, because we realize that Satan has always pitched a big tent, has he not? You know, we think of big tents. You got those at gatherings, you know, you have this big area and there's just a lot of people included, and it doesn't really matter. You know, it's just okay, come on in. It's not restrictive. The devil pitches a big tent. I think in life we must remember the old adage that one with God is a majority. Now, I don't think that we should use that to be obstinate, because that can happen too. Instead of steadfast, we become stubborn. That can definitely happen. And you know, it happens to good people too, including myself. You know, you get entrenched in a thought and you... it's right, it's good, it needs to happen. And after a while, you slide from being steadfast to being stubborn. And I'm not applying instances of where that's true or not true. I'm just saying let's be careful about that. But, one with God is a majority. We see that in Luke 6 and verse 26. Woe unto you, when all men shall speak well of you, for so did their fathers to the false prophets. You know, that's scripture. Woe unto you if everybody has something good to say about you, because you can't please everybody all the time. And if you do, you're probably talking two different ways. It just doesn't happen that way. And we need to be careful with that. You know, God forbid that we would be stubborn, but if we are to make it to glory, we must be steadfast. And like Noah, we must be willing to preach day and night, labor day and night for how many years? Sim, did it say that he preached? Was it 120? 120 years that Noah preached, and in the end it was just 8 souls that were saved. Was it because he was stubborn? No, it was because he was steadfast. And the people didn't want to listen. In closing, I want to turn to the book of Daniel and read a number of verses out of Daniel chapter 6, beginning in verse 1. This is Daniel at the end of his life. He's an old man. He's approaching 70 years old at this point. You know, we think of Daniel, and at home I have a motto on the wall. It's not a motto, it's a picture. It's a framed picture. I like it a lot. It's a picture of Daniel in the lion's den, and there's a number of problems with the picture. One is it shows Daniel as a young, strong, you know, individual, and I just don't think that wasn't true. Daniel wasn't young and he wasn't strong at this point. He was an old man. The other thing, it shows the lions, just big, fat, sleek lions, just like you would see off of the National Geographic magazine or something like that. But I think these lions were mangy. They were starved. They were hungry. You know, these weren't pets that he was thrown into there in the den. But it says in verse 1, it pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 princes, which should be over the whole kingdom, and over these 3, presidents of whom Daniel was first, that the princes might give accounts unto them, and the king should have no damage. Then this Daniel was preferred above the presidents and princes, because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king thought to set him over the whole realm. Then the presidents and princes sought to find occasion against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could find none occasion nor fault, forasmuch as he was faithful, neither was there any error or fault found in him. Then said these men, we shall not find any occasion against Daniel, this Daniel, except we find it against him concerning the law of his God. Then these presidents and princes assembled together to the king and said thus unto him, King Darius, live forever. All the presidents of the kingdom, the governors and the princes and the counselors, and the captains have consulted together to establish a royal statute and to make firm decree that whosoever shall ask a petition of any god or man for 30 days save of thee, O king, he shall be cast into the den of lions. Now, O king, establish the decree and sign the writing that it be changed not according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which altereth not. Wherefore King Darius signed the writing and the decree. Now when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went into his house, and in the windows being open in the chamber toward Jerusalem, he kneeled upon his knees 3 times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as he did aforetime. And these men assembled and found Daniel praying and making supplication before his God. In thinking about Daniel, he was aware of the plot against him, and he knew what it meant. He knew that all of these men had gathered in jealousy against him and had bribed the king. But it says that when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went into his house with his windows being open. You know how? I just have to put myself in his position. It'd have been easy to just shut the windows. You know, just close the windows. Pull the curtains. They don't have to see. You know, that would have been an easy response, and it would have been a temptation, I'm sure. But you know, we see that Daniel did not do that. He refused to do that. Instead, he opened the windows and he prayed like he always did. And I have to ask myself the question, why didn't he close the windows? Was it a testimony to the pagan officials? And it possibly could have been. But I think that Daniel did not close the windows for his own personal benefit. I think it was because of something that he felt he needed to do. I think that he understood the need to identify with truth. And Daniel also understood that unless he was willing to defend truth, he would lose truth. I think that was true in his life. And I think that's the message that he has for us, you know, today. So as we think about the dangers that face the church, we realize that God has all of the answers for those, and we're thankful for that. All we have to do is to remember the four-letter word, and that is what? O-B-E-Y. Obey. Thank you for each one gathering out this evening. I ask that you would continue to pray for me. I feel a need for that.